Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
I think there's a growing view in the United States that we shouldn't have new members until the current members all hit their 2% commitment and targets.
Senator Dan Sullivan argues for more military spending from NATO member countries. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, July 11th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Anchorage prepares to open a former hotel as low-income housing.
Anchorage needs housing more than ever, and so any amount of rooms that we can get up and running, we're grateful for.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
You know that eating fruits and vegetables supports good health, but did you also know that frozen and canned produce offers the same health benefits as fresh? It's true. Whether fresh, frozen, canned, or from the land, eating fruits and veggies can lead to a long and healthy life. So when it comes to getting the fruits and veggies you need to stay healthy, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by Snap.
U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan was in Lithuania today for the NATO summit. In a press conference with other members of Congress, Sullivan said the point of their visit was to show bipartisan support for the treaty alliance and for continued military assistance to Ukraine. Sullivan, though, spent more of his time noting that too few NATO member countries are living up to the pledge to spend 2% of their gross domestic product on defense.
One of the reasons this is important, the lack of progress on this issue. Last year, 7 of the 31 members of NATO hit their 2% GDP target, has the potential to actually undermine continued U.S. support for Ukraine. Those issues, in my view, are tied together.
A report this week from NATO says 11 member countries are now meeting the 2% spending goal. In relative terms, Poland spends the most on defense at nearly 4% of its GDP. The U.S. spends about 3.5%. Sullivan says American support for adding Sweden and Ukraine to NATO could be contingent on how much other countries spend on their armed forces.
With regard to NATO, I think there's a growing view in the United States that we shouldn't have new members until the current members all hit their 2% commitment and targets.
Over the years, American political leaders of both parties have complained that European countries are essentially freeloading while the U.S. invests in their common defense. But former President Donald Trump has made it a signature issue. He discussed withdrawing the United States from the alliance if other nations didn't meet the 2% goal. An Alaska Aviation Legends plane struck a tree during a windy takeoff near Shaktulik last month, moments before the crash that killed him and his passenger. That's according to a report released today by the National Transportation Safety Board about the June 16th crash that killed longtime Bush pilot Jim Tweedo and Idaho hunting guide Shane Reynolds. NTSB Alaska Chief Clint Johnson says investigators reached the site days later.
What they found was the airplane appears to have struck a large snag or a dead tree during takeoff, and the airplane crashed shortly after that.
According to the report, Tweedo was making 3 trips that day to get hunters, their 2 guides, and their gear from a remote camp near Shaktulik to Unalakleet. The airstrip near the camp was on a sloping mountain ridgeline, so Tweedo had to land his Cessna 180 uphill, then take off downhill. Tweedo flew the 2 bear hunters out earlier in the day. Then he returned to take Reynolds. The plane crashed 300 feet below the airstrip. The second guide, who would have been on the next flight, reported the crash just after it happened. A responding helicopter pilot said winds in the area that day were rapidly shifting in direction and speed. Investigators found a broken 4-inch thick tree on the runway's left side, matching damage found on Tweedo's plane. Johnson says investigators are still gathering information on the crash. The wrecked plane is now in Nome and being brought to Anchorage for inspection.
What we do now is do a wreckage layout. Again, that's standard procedure for us. We're going to be looking very closely at that airframe and also the power plant, the engine.
Johnson says Alaska's aviators are still coming to terms with losing Tweedo. He was known nationally from the Discovery TV show Flying Wild Alaska, featuring family airline Era Alaska.
It is pretty amazing how the aviation community has come together and and to support the family. It's pretty heartwarming, I got to be honest with you.
A factual report on the crash is expected later this year, with a final report in the next 12 months. Alaska voters of the not-too-distant future might end up deciding on whether to raise the minimum wage, mandate paid sick leave, or limit campaign contributions. That's if the State Division of Elections certifies three recently filed citizen initiatives, and if they get enough signatures to make it onto ballots. Alaska Beacon editor Andrew Kitchiman made it all the way into here to talk to us about these proposed ballot measures. Andrew, these all just kind of happened to get filed the day after Independence Day, and they do different things, but one of them is mostly focused on labor laws in the state. Can you tell me, I guess, the first part of that I'd like to talk about is this paid sick leave part of it. What would that do, and who is pushing for that?
Yeah, it would mandate that every job in Alaska have some level of paid sick leave. You would accrue it, that, you know, you would build it up as you work days over the course of the year. You would be entitled to more leave. For very small employers, it would be the equivalent of 5 days. And employers that have at least 15 workers, it would be the equivalent of 7 days of paid leave.
And so that's per year. And is it for full-time, part-time employees, or just everybody?
It's based on how many hours you work.
Okay. And now, so the same ballot initiative, if it gets approved by the Division of Elections, and if they get enough signatures, it would also ask voters to raise the minimum wage. So where are we at with the minimum wage? Also, what would this do to raise it?
The current minimum wage is $10.85 per hour, and it would bring it up gradually. It would be $13 in July of 2025 if this were to pass, and then up to $14 a year later, and then up to $15 in July of 2027. Another piece of this is once it reached 15, it would continue to go up as inflation increases after that. It's supported by labor unions, so you're going to see the AFL-CIO in Alaska both work to get the signatures and to get it passed. They'll be trying. That's according to Joelle Hall, who's the president of the Labor Federation.
There's also a third part to this labor initiative. What's that?
It basically would bar employers from requiring employees to sit through religious or political presentations. So there's no restriction as on an employer doing that kind of talk. It's just that they couldn't require people to sit through it.
So I could just get up and leave then, basically.
Yeah, I'm not sure what that would look like in practice.
So that's the labor initiative that was filed here just recently, the day after Independence Day. But there were two other ballot measures that folks are trying to get enough signatures for. And I guess the second one that we can talk about, that deals with campaign contributions.
Yes.
Can you remind me why are people talking about setting limits? I thought there were limits. What happened to those?
We had them at one time, and they were disallowed a couple years ago, essentially invalidated because they were too low, according to the federal courts. It was essentially a restriction on speech.
That used to be $500, I think, right, per person, per year, per candidate.
Yes.
And then, like you said, the court struck that down. They said it was too low, but that basically just got rid of any kind of a limit, right?
Yeah, so this last election was the only election we've had in many years where there were no restrictions on the election last year in 2022. And so if this were to pass, that number, which used to be 500 and is currently nothing, would be $2,000 over a 2-year campaign cycle. So basically, without adjusting for inflation, it's about double what the old limit was.
And then the third ballot measure that's seeking certification from the Division of Elections, what is that one? It deals with something that's kind of not a problem right now under ranked choice voting, but if ranked choice voting were repealed, it would be an issue. Can you explain that?
Yeah, well, there is a possibility that ranked choice voting, the current election system, could be repealed because there's a question already been submitted, already certified, and now out actively having people gather signatures to try to put it on the ballot. That measure would repeal the current system. Well, of the three questions that were submitted to the division last week, one of them, what it's basically saying is, however you pick candidates under a partisan nomination system, the cost has to be borne by the parties. The reason that's not relevant in the current system is that the current system is not a partisan system. The way that you advance through the primary is through an open primary instead of a party primary. And so it's basically something that would become effective if this other ballot question was successful.
And I think we heard reporting last week from our own Alaska Public Media reporter, Wesley Early, that that group that's trying to repeal ranked choice voting has, I think they said, 20,000 out of that 26,000-27,000 signature limit that they need to hit.
Yeah, it looks like there's a very good chance that that will be on the ballot.
We will stay tuned to your reporting on that, Andrew. That was Alaska Beacon editor Andrew Kitchenman. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Casey.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, scientists are studying seaweed harvested on Alaska's shores.
Next time you're walking the beach, if you look a little bit closer at that rack line, you might be surprised at how much, you know, life you can find in there.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Quality childcare creates futures for families, children, and the state's economy. When children are safe, engaged, and learning, parents can work and everyone has a better outcome. Thread has resources to support your family in their childcare search. Knowing what to look for in a licensed facility is important for the safety of your children. Thread also offers parenting resources and support. To learn more about quality childcare in Alaska, visit threadalaska.org. This message sponsored by Thread.
The Sitka Fine Arts Camp is suing three federal agencies for failing to grant a work visa for the organization's theater director. The camp alleges that its technical theater manager, who oversees the operation of the Sitka Performing Arts Center, was wrongfully denied an H-1B visa, which covers specialty occupations that require advanced academic education and training to perform. According to the brief filed July 7th, the Sitka Fine Arts Camp had previously employed the individual under an optional practical training program, or OPT, which allows foreign students to work in their specialty for 1 year following graduation. The individual in question had recently earned a Bachelor of Fine Art in Theater Performance from Midwestern State University in Wichita Falls, Texas. The Sitka Fine Arts Camp hoped to extend the employment by filing a petition to classify him as an H-1B non-immigrant, which would have allowed him to keep working for another 3 to 6 years. The United States Customs and Immigration Service denied the application on June 16th, prompting the lawsuit. The Sitka Fine Arts Camp argues that the agency's decision was arbitrary and impeded the camp's mission of providing Alaska youth with exposure and training in the arts. The camp is seeking a reversal of the H-1B denial and attorney's fees and costs. The Kenai Peninsula Borough Assembly is deciding whether to back a proposed rule to ban trans girls from women's high school sports teams after that rule advanced at the statewide school board meeting in Soldotna last month. The board advanced a resolution that would only allow girls assigned female at birth to compete in a girls' sports division. It would also create a new division for students that, quote, identify with either sex or gender. The proposed rule is open to public comment through July 26th, when the state board could vote on it. Tonight, the Kenai Peninsula Borough Assembly will decide whether it wants to show formal support for that proposed rule. The Kenai resolution's co-sponsor, Richard Durkavorkian, says it aims to, quote, preserve a fair playing field for all competitors while allowing for open opportunities for competitors, end quote. The proposed rule echoes more than a dozen others that have been created around the country as states move to ban trans girls from girls' high school teams. At the state school board meeting in June, Alaska school board member Bob Griffin supported putting the resolution out for public comment.
I think it's important that we address this before it becomes a problem, because that information from other places across the United States indicate that it has been a problem in other places and that it's likely to occur here.
The resolution also received support from members of the Soldotna High School women's wrestling team and several community members. But opponents say it's an affront to trans rights and creates more barriers for an already marginalized community. A non-voting student representative to the board, Felix Myers, decried the resolution at the Soldotna meeting and pointed out that there has only been one trans female student athlete in Alaska.
I don't think this should move to public comment because I don't think this should be something that we entertain.
The Alaska Beacon reports that legislative attorneys say the resolution is likely to be challenged in court. Well, large swaths of Western Canada are ablaze in a record-shattering wildfire season for the country. Now, people in Southeast Alaska are starting to see the smoke, and as KFSK's Shelby Herbert reports, there's more to come.
Petersburg resident Brad Hunter woke up to murky skies on the morning of Friday, July 7th. By sheer coincidence, that was the day after what Petersburg firefighters are calling the worst structure fire the community has seen in decades. At first, Hunter thought the pale fog came from the blaze at the local Catholic church.
And I noticed the smoky haze down towards the east, kind of towards the Stikine River. And you know, at first, of course, you think, well, we had that smoke in town on Thursday. But then it was apparent that it was a different type and a different source for the smoke.
On that day alone, more than 22 million acres of British Columbia and the Yukon Territory went up in flames, breaking a record that was set over 30 years ago. A few of the fires are right behind the coastal mountain range, just due east of the Alaska Panhandle. The intense fires blew smoke thousands of feet in the air over the Boundary Range. That's why, back in Petersburg, Hunter couldn't see the usual landmarks on the Canadian border.
You know, and then Devil's Thumb disappeared, and then eventually even the Front Range, you know, towards Horn Cliff started disappearing and through the haze.
Andy Park is a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Juneau. He's been tracking the smoke across the border and says there's no cause for concern quite yet. The air quality levels are still fair, at least compared to cities on the eastern seaboard of the U.S., which were choked with smoke from Canadian fires in early June. But Park says things could get worse around here.
If you see really increased fire activity today, that'll push more smoke to Juneau, Ketchikan, Petersburg, and up in the Skagway. So we'll have to watch what those fires do in the future. Right now, with the models that we have in terms of smoke forecast, it looks to stay more north of Petersburg, but you would really have to pay attention to how those fires boil up today.
Alaska is in for some smoke, but so far there's been very little fire. Mark Smith is a meteorologist with Alaska's Division of Air Quality. He says Alaska's fire season had a late start, but Canada's coming in hot.
This year, Alaska is not burning. We've only had 1,400 acres to date burnt. Typically, even during a low fire year, we'll have 200,000 acres by this time. But the high pressure has been dominating in Canada. There is hundreds of fires through Yukon Territory, British Columbia, and Alberta.
So when will it stop? Smith's weather models predict it could take a while for the smoky days to pass, possibly until the end of summer.
Well, typically, we're in fire season until the rainy season starts, but we're still looking at the Canadian fires being dampened, not till August. So we still have another month of smoke potential.
Central Southeast, near Petersburg and Wrangell, could get the most of that smoke on account of the flow of air over the Stikine River. Smith explains.
Petersburg would have the ability to be impacted from the smoke quicker than a lot of the other areas due to the drainage. So as the smoke kind of moves into the mountains from the east, that drainage flow would help steer and channel the smoke into Petersburg.
More detailed data for the area is limited. There aren't any air quality sensors in Central Southeast. The closest are actually in Ketchikan. But sensors to the north and south are clocking in good air quality levels. Sensitive groups like children, older adults, and people with lung diseases can still safely enjoy the outdoors. So, for now, folks can breathe easy and enjoy stunning sunsets and sunrises stained scarlet by wildfire smoke. In Petersburg, I'm Shelby Herbert.
For real-time smoke updates, you can check out the Alaska Division of Air Quality's website at dec.alaska.gov.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from oversized equipment to small packages for commercial or residential. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Invasive plants and animals threaten Alaska's waters and can spread to new locations by hitching a ride. Anyone can help stop aquatic hitchhikers by remembering to clean boots, boats, and trailer to remove plants, animals, and mud. Drain bilge, ballast, and buckets before leaving the area, and dry equipment before using it in a new body of water. Learn more at stopaquatichitchhikers.org. This message sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Alaska's labor shortage and declining population might have more to do with the smaller number of people coming into the state than the number of people leaving. That's according to longtime state economist Neil Fried. During a discussion today on Talk of Alaska, Fried said Alaska has for years led the country with its population turnover.
We have the biggest turnover in our population every year. We're number one in the country, and that obviously lends itself to non-residency. The other big factor in non-residency is the seasonality. We are the most seasonal state in the country when it comes to employment.
Fried is one of the longest-serving economists for the state of Alaska. He started the job nearly 45 years ago and is planning to retire this summer. He says because of the high population turnover in Alaska and large number of seasonal workers, the state depends on new people moving in from out of state. Fried says that's not happening as much now, and it's a challenge for employers.
One of the reasons is because the American economy has been so healthy for so long that migration from state to state has declined to record lows in the last 5-6 years in the country, and we're very dependent on migration, and it's having a big impact on us.
That creates a mixed bag for Alaskans. On one hand, the labor shortage is an opportunity for Alaskans seeking employment to earn more and change occupations, while the lack of available workers hamstrings employers struggling to operate with so many open positions. A former hotel in Midtown Anchorage that the city bought more than 2 years ago is weeks away from reopening as low-income housing. Shelter and housing operator Henning Incorporated signed an agreement with the city's real estate department at the end of June to use the building for the time being. Rob C. is the community liaison for Henning.
We're ready to move people in now if we had the approval.
He says Henning plans to move paying renters into the former Golden Lion Hotel on 36th Avenue after the Anchorage Assembly approves a long-term lease. A $1 per year lease to Henning is on the Assembly's agenda for introduction at its meeting tonight, putting it on track for a public hearing and final vote on July 25th. The operation is not expected to rely on ongoing funding from the city. C says the tenants will pay their rent of about $800 through a combination of work, housing vouchers, and other benefits they receive. C says as of yesterday, they had 17 people ready to move in. He expects all 80 available rooms to fill quickly. Alexis Johnson, the mayor's homelessness coordinator, says the administration is excited about the additional housing.
Anchorage needs housing more than ever, and so any amount of rooms that we can get up and running, we're grateful for.
The opening will follow years of controversy over the former hotel as local elected officials turned over and plans shifted. Seaweed from Alaska's beaches makes really great plant fertilizer. And more people on the Kenai Peninsula are catching on as harvesting the marine plant becomes more popular. Now, researchers are putting seaweed under the microscope to make sure the harvest isn't causing harm to the populations that rely on it to survive. Sabine Pooks reports for KBBI.
From above, the seaweed on the beaches of Homer and Anchor Point doesn't look like much. But under the microscope, there are entire worlds in every sample. That's what University of Alaska Fairbanks researcher Brian Ulaski found when he analyzed the seaweed that had washed up on Homer beaches, also called wrack. His team found thousands of organisms in samples they collected 2 years ago.
Next time you're walking the beach, if you look a little bit closer at that wrack line, you might be surprised at how much, you know, life you can find in there.
Ulaski's study comes on the heels of an uptick in interest in wrack from commercial and personal use harvesters. One farmer in Anchor Point has been using seaweed for decades to make a potting soil called fishy peat. In the last couple years, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game has started issuing permits for the harvest, about three per year. Research biologist Ted Otis says Alaskans are catching on to the seaweed hype.
A lot of local folks collect grass off the beach for their gardens. We were just trying to get ahead of it a little bit and learn a little bit about that resource.
Area management biologist Glenn Hollowell says in the last 8 or 9 years, the Department of Fish and Game started taking a harder look at seaweed.
We realized that kelp on beaches wasn't like going out and picking up driftwood or rocks or something. This stuff may have value.
To learn more about that seaweed, Fish and Game got in touch with the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And that's where Ulaski comes in. To gather samples, he used clam guns to punch holes into the rack line and the sediment below at about a dozen sites near Homer, from Anchor Point to Bishop's Beach on one side of the bay, and then between Seldovia and Gruink River on the other.
So when we looked at those samples, you know, in the lab and under the scope, there were a lot of critters.
Over more than 6 months of sampling, they found over 47,000 different invertebrates in the rack, like coastal centipedes and pseudoscorpions.
You don't really see much activity in the rack unless you're looking at it really closely. Then you're like, okay, yeah, I can see things moving around. There's a beetle there. There's a beach hopper hopping around and flies flying around. So it was kind of a pleasant surprise, the amount of organisms we found in those samples.
Brenda Konar is a professor with the College of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences at UAF. She says the study is a good benchmark for what organisms are found in the rack.
So if there's any question or concerns about certain types of organisms or certain species, we kind of can go to this list and see, well, we know that these things exist there.
She says that information is important for other species that feed on rack in those areas, like shorebirds.
And that's one of the concerns, is that if too much of it is harvested, then all of these organisms that these birds rely on aren't going to be around because their habitat isn't there.
And Konar says harvesters should think about the tiny but abundant ecosystems they're harvesting when they hit the beaches on the southern peninsula.
Sort of similar when you go into the forest and you harvest your mushrooms, you know, those are like little ecosystems. And it's kind of just cool to think about what all is happening there.
Hollowell with Fish and Game says already the research is informing the work he does at the management level. He says a presentation Ulaski gave to the Board of Fish in 2019 helped direct policy on commercial and personal use seaweed harvest. In Homer, I'm Sabine Pooks.
That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin, Chris Clint, Jeremy Shea, and Madeline Rose in Anchorage, Riley Borden in Kenai, Shelby Herbert in Petersburg, Rob Woolsey in Sitka, and Sabine Pooks in Homer. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Air Cargo, serving the commerce and business needs of 20 Alaska communities, from Adak to Barrow to Ketchikan. More information at alaskacargo.com.
And by
Princess Lodges, offering glass-domed railcar tours to Talkeetna and Denali National Park for Alaska summer adventures. Your journey begins at princesslodges.com.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.